Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. The Canadian rock band Whitehorse manages to affect a concert sound that belies the fact they're just a duo, with a creative use of guitars, drums, telephone handsets, and a looping pedal. Luke Doucette and Melissa McClelland can pull off a wide range of sounds, from introspective to rocking to even spaghetti western.
The two performed an unplugged set for us in the Lake Effect Performance Studio recently, which is just as nice to listen to. It does include this song called Baby What's Wrong.
With a handful of his hair, she tells him, you are my toy. She winds him up so tight that he can barely breathe. Lying in a tangled mess that he can never leave. Baby, what's wrong? I'm afraid to ask you. Baby, what's wrong? Tell me, what did he do? Is there no loving in the aftermath of a sad, sad song? Baby, what's wrong? I'm afraid to ask you. Baby, what's wrong? Tell me, what did he do? Is there no loving in the aftermath of a sad, sad song? Is there no loving? Sad, sad song.
Whitehorse, Melissa McClelland and Luke Doucette, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's Baby What's Wrong. And Melissa McClelland, I have to say, those are some amazing notes you hit in that song.
Yeah, it's the spaghetti western part of the song.
Spaghetti western, a little, I mean, it could be opera. I mean, there's a certain, I mean, exaggerated drama that that you wear very well.
Oh, thank you. Well, I have to say, singing backups for Sarah McLachlan taught me how to sing that high. I never, ever went into that part of my voice for years, and then she kind of forced me into it, and now I love it.
I don't, you know, I have to say, not to contradict you, but I do recall a little recording of you as a three-year-old where you were hitting some notes
that
were...
That's
true. I believe the song was called Keep Walking,
Keep
and it was
walking.
Melissa shrieking at, like... you know, 3 kilohertz.
Well, the song kept modulating. That's how I wrote it. It would just keep going up, 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 up.
You wrote
up.
The song at 3.
Yeah, and it had a number of modulations in it.
Yes.
Key changes.
And by the end, I'm singing and, you know, I think only dogs could hear me at that
point.
It's like
a Mariah Carey whistle at the end.
Have you recorded it since?
No. No, but I still have that recording somewhere.
I am stunned that you were writing music at 3. I mean, this is something you'd wanted to do since you were really a toddler.
Yeah, as long as I can remember, I was making up songs and singing them. And I didn't pick up the guitar until I was 15. I kind of messed around on the family piano when I was 7 or 8, and I'd make up songs. But as soon as I picked up a guitar at 14, 15, around that age, that's when I really... became serious about songwriting and recording and performing.
Luke, I hadn't intended to go down this road, but how young were you when you first started?
Well, when I was 3, I wanted to be a fire truck. So Melissa and I are clearly different in that regard.
Similar sounds, though.
Similar sounds, yeah. I was singing in the choir at school when I was like 7 or 8 years old, and I used to get all the solos because I could also hit the high notes at the, except I used to faint. I had this weird fainting thing where I would just collapse.
You were like those sheep.
Yeah, I get nervous and I just fall over. But that's when I realized that music was something that I had a bit of an aptitude for, but it didn't occur to me that it might be something one could pursue as a vocation or anything other than something I did at school until I was probably 13. My mom got me a guitar for my 13th birthday, I think. And then it was my cousin's boyfriend at the time who came over and he showed me how to play Squeeze Box by The Who.
Mama's got a squeeze box he wears on her chest, and when daddy gets home, he never gets no rest. And just play it all night, and the music's alright. Mama's got a squeeze box, daddy never sleeps at night.
And I was so blown away that a mere mortal could play a song by The Who, and I was a huge fan of The Who at that time in my life, and it's really the ignorance of my ignorance that lured me into music, because it shouldn't have blown my mind that a mere mortal can play three chords. But I had this idea that, well, if you're in a famous band, you must be a wizard of some kind. And I was just a kid with a BMX. I wasn't a wizard at all. But it convinced me that maybe I could work hard at it. If I worked hard at it, then, you know, who knows where it could go. So I guess I was 13. I started writing songs right away. They were terrible, and I didn't really write a song that anybody should ever hear in for a good 6 or 7 years after that, or even longer. But, you know, I started practicing 6, 7, 8 hours a day pretty quickly when I was 14, maybe 15. And I was a bit of a slave driver when it came to the bands I had in junior high school. Like one year when we were 15 years old at River Heights Junior High School in Winnipeg, Manitoba, the band we had, which I think was called the Cutaways at the time, we practiced 360 days that year. We practiced on Christmas Day. Now, fortunately, you know, 3/4 of the band were Jewish, and so they didn't mind practicing on Christmas Day.
We talked a little bit about this the last time you were here. You know, your live performance in the studio here is a lot different than what people will see at a White Horse show. And both of those are necessarily different than what they hear on a White Horse CD. In some ways, it almost seems a little unfair to put to kind of freeze you in time on a CD. I mean, when do you decide, well, this is going to have to do because, you know, we know we're never going to sound on our CD the same way we sound anywhere else?
That's actually a challenge that we're up to, you know? We love trying to crack the code of how we can, you know, take the recorded piece and somehow turn it into a live show that's just as big and exciting for us and the audience.
I have to say it's usually Melissa's enthusiasm because I'm not very good at rehearsing, and my attitude suffers poorly, terribly.
But that's changed since junior high school.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, now I just want to play. Like, I love to play. Like, I feel like in the course of a tour, let's say you do 100 shows in a year, maybe 30 of them will be really spectacular, or maybe even 60 if you're lucky. But if you rehearse 40 times, that's potentially 40 opportunities to play beautifully that people aren't going to see. So I just think don't bring your A game to rehearsal. So I just, rehearsing to me is always B game. And I just don't think it's fun.
It's an interesting process with White Horse because we're using a looping pedal. We're playing a lot of different instruments on stage. And we do have to reimagine every song. You know, we have to figure out a new arrangement that's going to work in the live setting. And there are a lot of cues and muscle memory that we have to get down. So it's essential for us to rehearse and to get to the point where we can be loose and free and have music, play music on stage and have it still be spontaneous and fun and improvise. But in order to do that, we kind of have to get the basics down.
Yeah. Well, and I was talking with another musician not long ago about whether she hears surprises in her music when she goes back and listens to it. And she said, actually, she does not go back and listen to it. And then I got to wondering, is that common? Do you ever listen back to what you've recorded?
It's funny because by the time a record comes out, we are so over it. and then, you know, all of a sudden we have to start talking about it. And, you know, we spend so much time in the studio obsessing over it. And
in a lot of ways, because so much goes under the microscope when you're recording an album, it's not always fun. There are cathartic moments. Maybe even the entire process is cathartic. But some of the steps to get from A to B, it's kind of like, you know, like giving birth. Not that I know, but Melissa does. Or like running a marathon. You know, the steps along the way can be painful. The achievement overall is really to be celebrated. But you don't want to go back. I wouldn't want to go back and remind myself what it feels like at mile 21. And listening to your albums to some degree is going back and experiencing some of the intensity of the studio. Not for the listeners, they love it. That's the whole point. But for us, it's like, no, that was a lot of work, and we're so happy we did it, and we love this record. Now let us move on and graduate.
And that being said, if enough time passes, there is a curiosity, and you do want to listen to your old stuff, and it's kind of like reading an old journal.
But this is well down the road.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, at the risk of making you relive childbirth here, is there another tune you want to play for us?
This is a song that perhaps inspires childbirth. This is called Tame as the Wild Ones. We were working on this record with Gus Van Gogh. We were in Toronto working on some songs. And Gus and I were going to head out one evening and after a long day of work, and Melissa had decided to stay home, but she figured maybe she could work on something in our absence. And so she asked Gus, like, what do you think this record is lacking so far? And Gus was like, well, we don't have anything truly sexy. We have lots of other things. We have politics and we have rock and roll and we have country music and blues and sadness and happiness, but we don't have anything truly dirty. So this is this is what Melissa came up with. And of course we like to joke that that we're on the road with a brand new baby, so clearly the song has been effective. Right. Is that in tune enough?
Sure.
I think so. Yeah. It would be enough for Neil Young, I think.
All right, let's do it.
Strange things have happened to me. Hell-bent on heavenly dreams. Oh, will I bury my feelings alive? Your hands, they travel like sin. Defenses are growing so thin. I keep still while better intentions die.
Great song. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, I feel like we've kind of talked around it, but we haven't really talked a lot about the new record. And I know you're so over the recording of it, but I hope I could ask you a couple of questions about it, because there's a lot on the album that sort of speaks to this dynamic of urban life versus really anything else. What got you to thinking about that?
Well, it's something that I have to say we've probably obsessed on more than most artists and on more than just this album. But it's been a preoccupation of mine personally since I was a little kid. I was born in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and I basically spent the remainder of the 70s in Halifax, the 80s in Winnipeg, Manitoba, the 90s in Vancouver, and then after that moved to Toronto. And then we spent some time in Nashville and in New York and in Hamilton. So with the exception of Hamilton, I've been steadily moving to larger cities my whole life. And I've always been really fascinated by that. I mean, when I was a little kid, 6 years old, if I missed the school bus, and I know this sounds like a cliche, but my mom would make me walk and it would be 2 miles to school and I have to cross through central Halifax. And then I would have to make my way home afterwards. And that was just always exciting and fun. You know, for me, gave me a sense of autonomy and freedom that I've always marveled at. And when I was 11, I took the train from Winnipeg to Halifax, which is basically like going from Minneapolis to Boston. I was by myself for 6 weeks. And then when I was 13, I went the other direction and went to the West Coast. So I've spent a lot of time by myself looking at cities. And I think that when you take millions of people and you stick them together really in a close-knit community and watch how generally they get along, I find that really heartwarming. And it's fodder for optimism and for a certain amount of hope for humanity.
And, you know, from my end of it, I grew up in the suburbs of Toronto, and I called my first record Stranded in Suburbia. And so I've always romanticized the big city, and I'm a very solitary person, so I've always loved the feeling of being alone in the city but never lonely, because there's so much going on around you and so many different people. And it's really hard not to completely romanticize all of that. And it's really inspiring for songwriting when you're just passing through a town and you can just imagine what is actually going on in that place at that time.
You mentioned you went to a French immersion school in Halifax, and I think we talked not long after The Fate of the World Depends on This Kiss was released. Between that album and this album, you actually recorded an album in French, which I think would surprise a lot of, maybe not surprise people who know you, but there are not a lot of musicians out there who'll try something in another language.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is just wanting to pay homage to the language. My father's Acadian, so the Doucette being Acadian, so the French is in the family, although our household was exclusively Anglophone because my father left when I was young and my mother only spoke English and so on and so forth. But also it was just practical. Quebec Quebec has 10 million people in it, and the way culture is promoted within Quebec, because Quebec has a vested interest in protecting its culture and its language, there are so many opportunities to play music there. If you can somehow ingratiate yourself to the Quebecois community, and there are various ways of going about that. If you're from Quebec, you don't have to be Francophone, but if you're from outside Quebec, you do. It's an unwritten rule. And so we realized that in order for us to access what is almost half of the touring market within Canada, not that Quebec represents half the population, but because they promote art and culture so well, every town has a beautiful state-of-the-art community center with PA systems and a proper theater. And it really is quite beautiful, the infrastructure they have set up for art and culture. So if you can get in, then it can really, instead of touring for 6 weeks in a year in Canada, you can tour for 12 or 15.
It was such a strange experience playing songs that we had played a million times in English and suddenly changing all the lyrics. And it was interesting how all of a sudden I would forget the guitar chords or the melody or the harmony in some cases. It was the weirdest thing because there's so much muscle memory at work there. But it felt like it was such a feat.
Well, yeah. And it's one thing to learn the songs and learn the words, but it's another thing to be able to really feel like you're actually expressing yourself in that language.
Absolutely. And we were emoting quite a bit singing en français. The first time we actually tried it in Quebec, The train.
Oh, Lac Mégantic. We did play a show in Lac Mégantic. And the, for those of you who are not familiar with the story in Lac Mégantic, a derailed train full of oil tankers exploded in the center of this small town and leveled the town and killed 50 people like in this blink of an eye and wounded. Actually, I don't think it wounded anybody because it was so hot there that if you were within range, you died. Otherwise, you're fine.
And, you know, just such a horrible story. The whole country was in mourning over that. And it was pretty powerful. That was one of our first Quebec shows, but to go there and to play for that community pretty soon after that tragedy, it was a really powerful thing.
And I hesitate to make this connection, but I hope you'll bear with me. I mean, I hope you don't mind if I ask you this. I have two strong lasting images of April 15th, 2013, one of which sticks in my mind. It was a picture of you having just finished the Boston Marathon that was posted to the White Horse Facebook page. And then, of course, there's everything that happened after that. We're having this conversation in the wake of the trial of the marathon bomber who survived. What do you make of how society views that event today?
Well, I think that kid, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, I think is that his name? You know, he's a young person who got led down the garden path on some very, very bad ideas. Now, whether those very bad ideas are radicalism wholesale or just the bare bones of Islam, you know, that's a debate that people can have. But clearly, you know, he and his brother went on a murderous rampage, and the fact that he's been found guilty, you know, maybe will provide a certain amount of closure for people who are still thinking about that. You know, it's a tough one for me. I haven't been back to Boston since, and I will go back. I'd love to go back. I'd love to run again. I don't feel like it's essential for me to sort of to pay tribute to that event. I mean, you know, how many people will die in Syria today? How many people will die in Afghanistan? You know, I don't want to diminish the severity of what happened in Boston, but I think that a little bit of context and perspective is always useful. I think that we need to be clear about what motivated those boys. You know, they were motivated by a disdain for American foreign policy and a disdain for the infidel as prescribed by their religion. I mean, those are two separate issues, but they're connected.
And at the end of the day, I would imagine that you really wish your memory of running the Boston Marathon was different.
Well, kind of, although to be honest, my memory of that day is mostly of a beautiful day, the great city of Boston, a million really nice people on the streets giving us incredible support. It's almost incomparable the amount of love and support that comes off the streets of Boston for the marathon. It's a really beautiful thing. And it was a beautiful day, and I had a great race, and Melissa was there, and her parents were there, and my dad was there, and, you know, it was positive on every level. I went home and went to sleep. I woke up 3 hours later and Melissa said, "Oh my God, look at your phone, turn on the television, open the blinds in the hotel." We realized what was going on. You found out about it before I did, you know, because I was asleep. And my memory of that day has more to do with my love for the city of Boston and the marathon than it does for what those two boys did. Horrible what they did. But I guess I'd rather focus on the positive of that day.
Well, and I would love to focus on the positive of your music. So before sure. Before I let you go, first of all, let me say, Luke, Melissa, thank you so much again for visiting us, and hope you'll see us again.
Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And do you have one more song you'd like to take us out with?
Yeah.
We do.
Pins and needles when you wake. Fodder for the scene. You've got time to make the case. You've got enemies to blame. This pilgrimage, this archaeology, a poppy field, a stencil line between your heart and mine. All the traffic lights obey as they usher us from town to some suburban underground.
Luke Doucette and Melissa McClelland are the Canadian band White Horse. They stopped by the Lake Effect studio recently before a concert at Shank Hall. They have some interesting stories they shared about the guitars they play. You can hear them at WUWM.com. Our in-studio performance was engineered by John Strelecki.
This mythology, a cigarette and gasoline into the air we breathe. Oh, fake your death and I'll fake funnies in the back, all the punchlines smudged to black, just insinuating that we had a laugh, but all the credits roll, pins and needles they deflate, and life will take its toll.